time for the best coverage of the top stories in sports. The Sports Wrap with Jason Page starts now.
Another week of the show starts now. Thank you, Chad Erickson. Good to have you all with us. Lots to do over the next 60 minutes. Week 5 in the NFL to recap. Major League Baseball LDS talk. College football with Bill Bender. Oh, it's a busy show. Dennis Bernstein will preview the NHL season with us as well. I had a chance to catch up with him late last week. We'll have that coming up as well. But Sam Yarnell is here, and boy, oh boy, Sam, let's deconstruct week 5 in the NFL, which is, look, parody is abound, man. Take the Vikings and take the Chiefs out of the equation, and we still don't know what the Chiefs are, minus Rashee Rice, which we're going to find out for the first time later on tonight. But, I mean, essentially, you've just got a league. I mean, through 5 weeks, I don't know if I – and look, I don't like to get hyperbolic. You know me. I try to avoid it. I try to avoid saying things like, I don't know if I've ever seen dot, dot, dot. But I don't know if through 5 weeks I've ever seen this kind of parity in the league where it feels like sans the Chiefs, sans the Vikings, there's just a whole bunch of other teams you could throw into a hat right now.
Yeah, you know, it's just like we came and right here on this show last Monday, I said it. It's a week-to-week league, and I think it was even more on display this week. Actually, I will say that this week it did feel like there was a little more of a regression towards normal than there has been through, like, week 4 was insane. Week 3 was wild. And it felt like week 5, you finally kind of got a grasp of, okay, this team wasn't supposed to win, and they didn't. This team, you kind of feel like they're going to let you down all season long. Oh, they let you down in week 5. I think week 5 is a good kind of mile marker in the NFL season.
So.
It's
not
all the way to Halloween.
Yeah, I don't think we've hit that barometer yet. I think the barometer's still kind of going wee 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 wee. I don't think we are anywhere close to knowing where all this settles. You know, Baltimore gets a win in Cincinnati, and we can talk about what happened there, obviously, with the Ravens getting the win over the Bengals, and wasn't a win you feel great about the way they played. Their defense struggled. Joe Burrow throws 5 touchdowns. His coach gets scared in overtime after Lamar Jackson fumbles away the football and basically hands the game to Joe Burrow and the Bengals. You get Zach Taylor and company saying, nah, you know what, nah, we'll just run it into the line 3 times, leave it to chance with a 50-something yard field goal. And we all saw how that wound up ending. And then in Buffalo, with the Buffalo and Texans, where Sean McDermott should have been fired on the spot and should have been forced to walk home from Houston for the way he managed that late game situation. You had the craziness with Josh Allen hitting his head on the ground, how he was ruled out with any sort of concussion, how that was ruled out as fast as it was, certainly needs to be investigated. I'm sure somebody is. It's over and over again in this league every week. The margins are just so close. Again, outside of the Chiefs, outside of the Vikings, and we talk about the Vikings, who get a win in London, you know, avoid the upset bid from the Jets late in that game, and Aaron Rodgers continues to just play sort of meh ball. He's not terrible. He still makes plays from time. He still makes plays from time to time that remind you that he's Aaron Rodgers, but at the end of the day, he's not playing well enough for that team to capitalize on what has been a really good defense, a championship contending defense. He's not playing well enough for that to be enough. And everybody thought that's what was going to be the difference for the Jets was Aaron Rodgers. Like I said, I'm left scratching my head coming out of most of week 5 with just the Monday night game to go and where we are right now, Sam.
Well, Aaron Rodgers is playing horribly. He looked awful in that game against the Minnesota Vikings over
today
in London. And I'm sure there are a bunch of New York Jet box score eaters out there that are going to come at me and say, oh, he threw for 244 yards and yada, yada, yada. The fact of the matter is his completion percentage was around 50%. He threw more interceptions than he did touchdowns. And oh, by the way, it was the first time he had thrown 3 interceptions in a game. I believe so. since COVID was a thing. Again, I said this on the show last. I said this on the show last week. I'll go back to it again this week. When you look at Aaron Rodgers statistically right now, even without the Achilles injury over the last 20 games now, it's the worst 20-game stretch of his career. It's no fluke. This is a former MVP who got too old and wasn't willing to hang up his cleats, and now the New York Jet fans are having to suffer, as they're all too used to doing, through the end of what is turning out to be a very ugly ending to a what was once a promising career. Listen, with the Bengals, their offense is fine. I mean, Joe Burrow threw for almost 400 yards and 5 touchdowns in that game. Lou Anarumo, I don't know what's going on. This is a guy who for years and years and years we regarded as one of the best defensive coordinators in the National Football League. All of a sudden doesn't look like he could stop a Texas Pee Wee football team out on an NFL gridiron right now. The Cincinnati Bengals are lost and they are in a bad way, and it's gotten to a point where it's going to start doing organizational damage. Joe Burrow in the press conference after the game yesterday talking about how the offense wasn't doing anything wrong, and we'll see what changes need to be made. Getting very interesting. Zach Taylor, that seat is starting to get warmer by the day. And Lou Anarumo, you're just about as good as gone at this point, my friend. It was a great career for you, but it just shows what 5 bad weeks in the NFL can do to somebody.
What I can't fathom is how you have an all-world quarterback who's thrown 5 touchdowns in the game, by the way, and you basically say, hey, you know what, we'll take our chances from 52 yards. And I get that kickers are better now than they have been in any year that we could ever remember from distance. But there is no way with with Joe Burrow as your starting quarterback that you in that situation can say, we're just going to hand the ball off and run it into the line 3 times in a row and take our chances on where anything could happen, and it did, on a 52-yard kick. I can't wrap my head around it. It's unforgivable in that spot. It's playing to lose. It's like I was texting with Tom Brenneman about this. It's like prevent defense only on offense. That's what it was. It was prevent offense. It was we're just going to run the ball into the line and kick. When you have Joe Burrow, who's thrown 5 touchdowns in the game, and the Ravens haven't been able to stop you all that much. Boggles the mind. We didn't get to the Niners and the Cardinals. We'll save that for Tuesday when we do some Tuesday leftovers. But we got some baseball to get to. Wow. What a wild weekend when it comes to the League Divisional Series. We'll talk about it next. Coming up in 10 minutes, Bill Bender stops by to talk some college football. Spend a couple of segments on that. Whoo! Talk about parody. You want to talk about parody, Sam Yarnell? College football? Oy vey. Lots of parody there. Let's get into some baseball, though. We'll do the college football with Bill coming up in about 10 minutes. And let's talk some baseball where the League Divisional Series got started on Saturday and Sunday. And there were some duds, but there were also some real barn burners. It feels like Phillies, Mets, every game is going to be a knockdown, drag-out affair. And in Los Angeles on Sunday night, the fans got a little testy. And Fernando Tatis answered, hey, he just said, I'm just going to hit a home run instead. Hit 2 home runs against the Dodgers. The fans were out of control. And, you know, somebody's got to bring the temperature down in that series because there's a lot of smack being talked, and fans feed off that. And that's what some of what you had in Los Angeles on Sunday night. And it almost got dangerous with items being thrown onto the field, balls being thrown onto the field. Padres get the win. They even the series up at 1. I venture a guess that it'll be a little more docile in San Diego. Hopefully it is. You know, you've got Phillies fans booing Brandon Nimmo when he gets hurt out in left field. I mean, fans, let's bring the temperature. This is the playoffs, man. This is supposed to be a fun time of the year. Your teams are playing when other teams aren't. Let's bring the temperature down just a little bit right now, because it feels like it's kind of teetering on the verge of getting out of control, Sam. But what was your big takeaway from the weekend?
Well, just on that real quick, it's going to get out of control, because when you think about what these fan bases have had to endure, you've got the Padres fan base who are coming off losing the Juan Soto trade twice, which I didn't know you could lose a trade for a player twice, and they somehow did it. The Padres are coming off of that and also putting $1 billion into their roster and it not working out for 3 years in a row. The Dodgers are coming off of putting $1 billion into their roster and it not working out the way anyone expected it to this season, and they were still a, 100-win team. The Mets, I mean, we talked about this last week. I can't do it much more with the Mets and my rants on them, but the bottom line, their whole fan base is upset because, well, they haven't had anything to cheer for in 40 years, and they also spent $350 million on two guys last year who they traded 6 months later. And then the Phillies have watched every team in their division, sans the Marlins, have postseason success since the last time they did, and that clearly just eats away at them. So each one of these fan bases left in the NL, they've all got something to play for. I don't think the temperature goes down at all in any of these series, but it's creating awesome moments within itself, right? Like the Jurickson Profar, noted good guy, in Major League Baseball. The Jurickson Profar trolling on Sunday night, which kind of set this whole thing ablaze, where he made the home run robbing catch and pretended he didn't. And by the time Mookie Betts had rounded second, he revealed that he caught the ball. It was awesome. It was tremendous. Great troll job. Don't like the guy, but respect the troll job. That's what lit this whole thing ablaze. Awesome moment. In the Philly series on Sunday night, Castellanos hits the walk-off, Jason. What's the first thing he goes and does? Goes and finds his son and hugs him in the crowd. Like, we're getting these awesome moments out of these insanely tense environments, which to me is what the playoffs are all about. There is this constant added tension all over the place, but that's what makes kind of these very unique and intricate moments.
Yeah, and you got a couple of tense series with the Dodgers and the Padres, Phillies and Mets. I don't think it's going to be as tense when it comes to the Guardians and Tigers and the Yankees and Royals. Let's be honest right now. It feels like we're on a collision course. When you just kind of look at the first two game, the first game of both of those series, you just kind of get the sense that you know where that's headed, whether it's in three games, whether it's in four games. I think the Yankees are coming out of that series. I think the Guardians are coming out of theirs. And that's probably what we're going to get. I know the Tigers have been resilient, beyond resilient, this year. As much as we talk about the Mets, the Tigers have obviously been equally as resilient and up to the task this year, but feels like Yankees Guardians is a pretty safe bet through one game.
I can't get all the way there. Yes, the Guardians will be there, hands down. Great story, Tigers. The Guardians flex their muscles in game one. I mean, that lineup at the end of the day is probably the most well-rounded in the American League. Here's the thing about the Yankees, and this is why panic button fully on the table for Yankee fans right now. Gerrit Cole looked terrible in game one. Horrible. And that was like the one thing that the starting rotation was supposed to stand on, especially, you know, there's obviously no one knows about Nestor. He'll throw on Tuesday, I guess, but it sounds like no one's hopeful that he'll come back the rest of the postseason. Rodon's been, whatever his career in the postseason. I think the Yankees needed a strong start out of Gerrit Cole, and the minor meltdown that he had for postseason pitching wise really just spells trouble, especially when you were going up against a guy like Seth Lugo or Michael Wacha, excuse me, rather than a guy like a Cole Reagans or a Seth Lugo, who the Yankees are going to have to turn around and face now.
I'm not worried about the Yankees, not in this series, because I don't think the Royals are at the level yet of this team. But I do think there's cause for concern beyond this series when you're talking about them squaring up against the Guardians. And the Gerrit Cole stuff is disconcerting. I mean, look, he showed some flashes towards the end of the season at an eight-inning start in his last outing, something like that, pitched really well. But there's got to be cause for concern if you're a Yankee fan right now. But also, you know, there was more, it was a longer layoff than you would typically have. So there was something to be said for that as well. Creatures of habit, especially Gerrit Cole, who likes to make every excuse under the sun. Oh, the game was delayed 15 minutes because of a ceremony. I couldn't pitch well. He's always got excuses for why he doesn't pitch well. We'll see what he does in his next start. But it feels like those two series, I have a pretty good idea when it comes to the Guardians and Yankees. Both of those teams are going to move on. I'll tell you what, though. I am fascinated to see what happens with San Diego and the Dodgers. Because there is a lot. I mean, there's old school animosity between the Phillies and the Mets. Yeah, you know, it's always been there. But now the Padres in the last few years have challenged the Dodgers, knocked them out of the postseason a couple of years ago. There's this real feeling. There's this real feeling in San Diego that this could be, you know, it could be something special. And they have the star power to match up with the Dodgers. They just do. So it's going to be fun. Hopefully we see five games in that series. Wouldn't surprise me if we did. All right, we're coming back. Bill Bender joins us on the other side. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to this Monday edition of the show. Let's do some college football. Get it away from NFL and playoff baseball. Kind of, because I got to ask Bill Bender a question who's hanging out with us. Hangs out with us every Monday on the show to recap the college football weekend. Yeah, I think about this parity thing in the NFL that's going on right now. And I mean, after Minnesota and the Chiefs, and who knows what the Chiefs are going to be post Rashee Rice, depending on how long he's out, all of that. And you just look, and there's just a ton of mediocrity. It's just everybody's mid after those two teams. And I'm still not 100% sold on Minnesota being inevitable, despite the fact that they're 5-0, although they are undoubtedly one of the best teams in a league of mediocrity. And then I look at college football, and I see all this parity. And I'm trying to figure out, is there a correlation between the parity that we're seeing in the NFL right now and it feels like the parity we're seeing in college football? Is there something you can do to link the two?
Yeah, I mean, you wanted NFL light, you will have it. How many undefeated teams are in the NFC right now? One. How many are in the AFC? One. How many are in the SEC? One. And they have 8 1-loss teams all of a sudden. Now, Jason, I think the SEC has the best PR because they will pass off these unbelievable losses over the weekend as you've got to bring it in the on the road in the SEC. Well, you lost at Vanderbilt, right? You lost at Arkansas. And I think we have to adjust the way we think about dominant teams. How much is that the portal and NIL? I'm not sure, but I am sure that if you are a top five team like Tennessee thought they were, you have to go to Arkansas and win that football game. If you're Alabama, I get it. You played this huge game against Georgia. You got to go win that football game. That's what the NFL teams have to do. They have to, you know, you go from Green Bay, for example, played the Rams, has to travel across the country, and then they go home and play the Cardinals. This is part of the game in the pro game. I am interested in the coast-to-coast trend between the Big Ten and the these realigned teams, though.
Yeah, I am as well. In the case of Vanderbilt, try and give me a – is this coaching? Is it the letdown factor coming off the win against Georgia? Like, how do you – what do you see when you watch that game that shows Vanderbilt being able to not just hang with but beat a team over a course of 60 minutes that's supposed to be such a prohibitive favorite?
Well, I'll answer it this way. I was at Ohio State, Iowa. Ohio State doesn't lose to unranked teams.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't lost to an unranked team since 2018. They take care of business when they have to take care of business. And that's something Kalen DeBoer is going to have to learn because Nick Saban didn't lose often against unranked teams. Alabama took care of business in those games, regardless of what happened the previous week. The defense has had 6 bad quarters, could not get off the field. You know, Vanderbilt was 12 of 18 on third down. Vanderbilt didn't turn the football over. Vanderbilt gave themselves hope for 4 quarters. Kalen DeBoer is going to figure out real quick that loss means more to those people in Tuscaloosa than that win against Georgia does, because that win against Georgia is expected.
Yeah, I was thinking about the parody thing. This is going to sound stupid. But I'll bring it up, and then you can laugh, because when I tell you I was watching Yale and Central Connecticut State University on a Saturday. See, there it is. That's exactly.
There's the sticker. Okay, go on.
But there's a reason I bring this up. And it's, again, the context of parity. I can't even tell you the quarterback's name from Central Connecticut State University. But what I can tell you is, because I don't remember it off the top of my head, what I can tell you is I'm watching this kid at Yale Bowl play against Yale, you know, FCS school, and he's chucking the football around, and I'm looking at his size, and I'm saying, this isn't a guy that typically goes to Central Connecticut State University. And I think you're seeing that, and I only use it, it's anecdotal, but I only use it in the context of how many now, is it that the pool is just getting so large? I predicted this years ago in college basketball, and Jay Billis laughed me off my own show, and now he looks like an idiot. This was in 2008, I said this to Jay Billis. This kind of parity was coming to college basketball because it's a very accessible sport. It's very global. You're going to have people coming here. You can only have so many kids on a college basketball roster. They have to go somewhere, and you're going to get parity in college basketball. That's what's happened. Is the same thing happening in college football? Is it that participation is up, more players, better players? You can't, even though college football rosters are massive, they can't be that massive. Kids want to play. They're going to go somewhere else, and that's why we're getting to where we are right now.
Well, I think the realignment trend we just mentioned, where USC isn't capable of going across the country and beating a Minnesota, you know, where Miami needs a 25-point fourth quarter comeback or late third quarter comeback to beat Cal on the road. And the difference between – now, there's still an upper tier, the Ohio State, Texas. I still think you have to bring it to beat a Georgia no matter what. But some of that talent is being dispersed a little differently. The conferences look differently. I like the competition. I mean, I'm a guy that I don't do, as you know, I don't do the college football versus NFL thing. I like them both. I can sit there all day on a Sunday. I can do the same on Saturday. I respect what the game's difference. Quarterback play would be my other answer. I mean, how good is quarterback play in college football? Is it good? I'm not sure the answer is yes, even though outside of some systems.
Wow. You're killing the quarterback play. So you think a lot of these guys are just system quarterbacks?
Well, I mean, kind of in some ways.
But like, isn't everybody, but hold on. Isn't everybody a system quarterback? I mean, Lamar Jackson's a system quarterback. I mean, what the Ravens are doing in the NFL is completely different from what a lot of teams do. I mean, can't you make that argument at every level?
I'll make it this way. When you watch a college football quarterback, they can hit the deep pass because guys are open, and they can hit, anybody can throw a bubble screen. Can you pitch? Can you throw between 10 to 20 yards? That's what NFL quarterbacks can do. Most of them. If you can't pitch in that 10 to 20 range, that's how I would play defense in college football. I would try to take away your deep ball. I would, you know, bubble screens. You can defend that. Can I defend you in that 10 to 20 box? And I don't know how many quarterbacks do that exceptionally well at the college football level.
Yeah, that's fair. What does all this do? I only got about 35 seconds left for you in this segment, and then we'll hold you over. But what does this do rankings wise? We'll expand upon it in the next segment, but just give me a general thought.
Well, other than Ohio State and Texas, who are pretty complete on offense and defense so far, I think it's pretty wide open from 3 to 22.
Boy, that helps.
Yeah, there you go.
We haven't even talked about Oregon. Got to talk about them. I mean, it's crazy right now. It really is. And again, the Big Ten becoming the Big 1000 obviously plays a big role in all of this. We're going to hang on to Bill Bender for one more segment. He's going to try and get over the fact that I was watching Central Connecticut State University play against Yale. Look at him. I know. You can laugh at me. It's fine. We're coming back. Don't go anywhere. Rolling along on this Tuesday, we keep the conversation moving on college football. Bill Bender, the Sporting News, does a terrific job. Did I tell everybody you were with the Sporting News when we started the last segment? Maybe I didn't. Bill writes for the Sporting News. He actually has a day job. He doesn't just come on with us every Monday.
I do have a day job, and it's funny you say that at the Ohio State game on Saturday.
Yeah.
they, you know how you have to introduce yourself in a press conference, Bill Bender, Sporting News. And, but Jerry, the SID introduced me first. And then I froze when it was my turn to talk to Ryan Day. I was like, oh, and he just looking at me like, where's the question, bro? And I'm like, oh, I don't know what to do. It's like an automated response, but yes, I do have a job and I do enjoy it.
All right. Fair enough. Let's talk about a couple of, you know, former Pac-12 teams now in the Big Ten. And give me some thoughts on Oregon, you know, and sort of where we are with the Ducks and what they've been able to do so far this year.
It's a huge statement game, huge opportunity for them Saturday. Huge game for Dan Lanning, too. You know, the guy that we all attribute the fourth down stuff against Washington last year. Well, you beat Ohio State. We won't talk about those games ever again. And the Buckeyes are rolling in there with this really complete football team. Oregon watched them Friday night. Love the running game when Jordan James is going. Worry a little bit about Dylan Gabriel if he's under duress in this game because he's up against a very good Ohio State secondary. And, you know, just I can't calculate without seeing it what Oregon's front seven is going to do against Ohio State's offensive line. I thought they got after it the other night with Jordan Birch. They can get to the passer. If they get to Will Howard like that, they're going to have a chance in this game. But program-wide, a huge statement for them with the biggest, you know, team in the Big Ten coming to them. I wonder how much Scarlet and Gray is going to be in that stadium. I'm really curious to see that as well.
With a guy like Gabriel, you know, 6 years playing college football, I mean, it has to help when you basically can become a professional college quarterback. And we're not talking about a guy that's just, you know, hung around and played a snap here or there. He's gotten a lot of snaps over the years.
Yeah, he called himself at Big Ten Media Day a portal baby and a COVID baby, and he had like seven other labels because he's played so much college football. He's like, you know, I'm the test case for this, and the NIL, that was another one. And, you know, here's a guy with an opportunity. Remember last year, he led Oklahoma to a victory in the Red River rivalry, and Oklahoma is playing Texas on the same day. I think there's some irony involved there that was the biggest win of the day. And he could lead the biggest win of the day here against Ohio State if he plays well. He had two really ill-advised throws in the red zone against Michigan State. The second one was bad. And
I was going to ask you about that.
Again, this Ohio State secondary with Denzel Burke, Caleb Downs, you can't make those throws. So Oregon has NFL tackles against Ohio State's edge rushers. That's going to be a great matchup for the football nerds out there. I try to watch it a little bit during the game, but it's almost you have to go back and watch it again when it comes to tackles versus edge rushers.
What'd you get out of Miami and Cal?
Entertained. I mean, come on, man. They were down 25.
Are you not entertained?
Quarter.
Yes.
That was great, a game. Now, we love conspiracy theories. I thought it was targeting, but I likened it to being out on the playground playing basketball with your buddies. You don't call that foul on game point. I guess that's what I guess the justification was, because I probably thought it was targeting, but at the same token, they pin Cal and then Cam Ward throws a 70-yard pass. So it's a little bit on Cal to win the game there and finish it out. But Miami's got, they've used all their nine lives. They have a bye week. They go play Louisville. I love Cam Ward. I love their offense. I think that defense is going to catch them in a game at some point. And you know, if I was power ranking the ACC, Clemson, SMU, and Pitt are all right there.
What do you see when you watch Cam Ward and you think about the next level?
I think he's fun. The thing that he does, wait till the last second to throw the football, and that works at the college level. He is a balance of, oh my gosh, look at that throw, and oh my gosh, why did he throw that? And I think he had so one true. Really bad interception against Cal that you can't. There are very few quarterbacks, regardless of level, that can safely throw the ball cross body, cross field. You know, Kyle McCord threw a bad interception against UNLV the other night trying to do the same thing. If you're Patrick Mahomes, yeah, you can do that. Aaron Rodgers, maybe he can't do that anymore.
Not anymore.
But that's what he'll have to learn at the next level, is you just can't turn the football over.
Yeah, you just can't make those sorts of mistakes. How about Washington and the small measure of revenge over Michigan?
Yeah, I mean, Michigan's got to pick a quarterback. They hit their bye week at the right time. I don't think they're quite dead yet, but I think they go with Jack Tuttle and just roll with it and then fix that problem before next year, because the honeymoon of the national title season will be over. I'm impressed that Washington was able to eliminate some of those mistakes with Will Rogers. I think I don't know if they're a factor in the Big Ten race, but I think Jed Fish can build off that victory against Michigan.
Give me the under the radar team right now that we're not talking about that everybody needs to be watching.
I said it earlier, SMU with Kevin Jennings. You look at their offense in the last three games since he took over as starting quarterback. Their only loss is a field goal loss to BYU, which in the present doesn't look that bad. And they could absolutely be a factor. The 80s child in me is looking forward to the possibility that the ACC championship could be Miami, who was that team that everybody branded a bunch of troublemakers when I was a kid, versus SMU, the only team to get the death penalty in college football. I think that would be amazing.
Real quick, do we just kind of hang on to Indiana or hang on any thoughts on Indiana until we get to that matchup against Michigan and then Ohio State the week after?
Next week against Nebraska, we're going to find out. Because Nebraska is an overtime away from being undefeated. So I love that matchup between the Huskers and the Hoosiers in week 8. And who knew I was going to say that in 2024?
And it goes full circle right back to what we were saying at the start of this. The parity in college football, it's how we get here. And it's why people got to watch every week between that and the NFL. The best drama on television right now. Bill Bender, the Sporting News, does a terrific job. That's what he does for a living. He writes for the Sporting News. Always appreciate it, my friend. Be well.
Hey, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
We're coming back. Welcome me back. Monday edition of Sports Wrap. Talking some NHL with the season getting started. Dennis Bernstein, thefourthperiod.com, SiriusXM NHL Radio hangs out with us. Florida, the biggest obstacle to them repeating as champions is?
Teams rarely repeat, Jason. They've climbed the hill. They won. And remember, they got to the cup final 2 years ago. They've played a lot of hockey. And they've had some, you know, they've had some defections. You know, Tarasenko left, Brendan Montour left and signed a big deal in Seattle. It's so difficult in this league to repeat. And I know, I get it, Tampa Bay did it. But this is, I think that's the biggest thing. It's such a hard hill to climb. And there's a lot of good teams out there. And Edmonton took them to, you know, 7-game limit, lost by one goal. It's just a very difficult repeat to a team to repeat in, league to repeat in. So you don't really see dynasties. I think that's it. The way the league is set up and how contentious it is and how close these teams are. I won't use the word, but I'll use it, parity. It's just so difficult to repeat, Jason.
The Rangers, we talked about them a little bit last week when we had you on. I want to get your thoughts on how they get over the hump that we talked about last week. What would be the difference between coming up a game short against the Panthers and being able to get past that point?
Well, the belief by the organization is that team, like, basically it's the same team coming back. There's one addition, Roy Smith coming in from Pittsburgh. He'll help on the right wing. I think it's the big players in big spots. Like, Mika Zibanejad has to be better in the playoffs, Jason. When the space gets tight and there's not a lot of room to operate, you're not playing, you know, the Columbus Blue Jackets on a Tuesday night, you're playing the Panthers in a game 6 or game 7, Zibanejad has to be better. Panarin, who's really injured right now and not really playing, is going to come back, and he has to be a big. Chris Kreider was great in the playoffs, and Shesterkin's got to be there. So it's the big players in big spots, Jason. If they can do that and produce, because it's happened a couple of seasons now, and they've lost the conference final 2 years out of three, and the same thing happened. The big guys didn't show up, right? And I get it. It's better teams. It's tougher defense. But that's the key for the Rangers. Will their top players produce in the playoffs, deep in the playoffs? Because I have no question they can win the division. Jason, I like them to win it all. I really do. But their big guys are going to have to show when it's really important.
A couple of franchises that have really struggled, one of them near and dear to our friend Sammy Arnell's heart. Is this the year Buffalo breaks the drought and gets back into the playoffs?
No, Sam. They're the biggest tease in the NHL, Jason. Every year they get close to the playoffs, and I think it's been 12 seasons that they haven't made the playoffs, and it looks really good, and they've got two first overall picks on the blue line in Dahlin and Power, and they always come up short. This has to be the year. This is a crucial year for general manager Kevin Adams because he's made some moves. You know, he traded away Jack Eichel, got a good return. But this team should be in the playoffs because when you look at Washington with a minus 37 goal differential last year and they made the playoffs, if you're Buffalo or you're Buffalo Sabres fan like Sam is, you're shaking your head saying, why wasn't our team in it? They have to do it this year, Jason. I think they have a good enough team. It's a young team with a young core. They've got size on defense. Tate Thompson needs a big bounce back season. But, you know, it's going to be difficult because what team are you going to take out of the top eight from last season? They're all pretty good. That puts Buffalo in. But this is a pivotal season for the Buffalo Sabres.
The Red Wings came up just one game short last year. We were all watching on the final night of the regular season as they came up short. How about Detroit?
Yeah, they're in the same grouping I see with Ottawa, Detroit, and Buffalo. Teams that really got to make it. There's a lot of pressure in Detroit. You know, they gave guys a lot of money. Larkin already got his money. They gave money to Sider, and they gave money to Lucas Raymond. Guys are getting paid now for what? Regular season? That's not what you pay guys for. You pay them for the playoffs. They need to make the playoffs as well. So, again, now we're talking about 10 teams for 8 spots, and maybe you can take the Islanders out of the mix, or maybe Tampa Bay takes another step backwards. It's another pivotal season for Stevie Yzerman. Is the Yzer plan working in Detroit? Only if he makes the playoffs, Jason. If he doesn't, then you got to question if he's the right guy to run the ship there. I'm not saying his job's in jeopardy there, but it's time to prove it. It's time to say that all the moves that you've made, and Stevie's been there for a minute, that's another team like Buffalo. You really got to get in the mix this season in the playoffs.
NHL hockey in Salt Lake City, what's it going to look like?
I'm going to be there. It's going to be great. Because here's the thing about Utah, Jason. That franchise, there's no excuses anymore. There's not a bad owner. There's not a bad arena. There's not playing in the college arena. There's no more excuses. And Bill Armstrong has a lot of assets. The preseason game they played up there against LA, the fans were great. Now, great. It's not an NHL building yet. It's going to hold 11,000 people, but that's twice as many as the Mueller Arena held. And there's, you know, there's obstructive view seats where you can only see one of the goals. It's not perfect, but it's a way better situation. This franchise is on track now with all the distractions away from them to really do some things. They could make some noise in the West. Do I think they're a division winner in the Central? No, but I think that the franchise, and as I mentioned before, the league's in much better shape. One of the reasons is you got out of the Arizona situation. You're in Utah now, but I will say this, Jason, at some point, when they get a legitimate owner and a legitimate building, they'll go back to Arizona. But Utah's going to be a really good success story. Maybe not to the level of Seattle and Vegas beforehand, so manage your expectations in Utah, but it's a really good situation in Utah with respect to ownership with Ryan Smith out there.
All right, last but not least, because I am in the belly of the beast here in Las Vegas, where the Golden Knights are just, I mean, the fan base here is insane. I had no idea until I got here just how crazy it is. Give me a sense for Vegas here as we get ready to start the season.
Well, the Vegas Golden Knights fan base is crazy because the other team in town is the Raiders, which, you know, we don't have to talk about them. The people, I think, are selling Vegas short. I really like a bounce back. Now, Marchessault left. He was an original Golden Knight. He was a 40-goal scorer. That was a big loss for this team. But, you know, they have Hanifin on blue line for the entire season. They have Thomas Hertl for the blue line also. They got rid of the distraction with Robin Leonard last week with respect to his contract. So I like that. Look, I like Edmonton to win the Pacific. But I really think Vegas can bounce back, not be a playoff wildcard team, but be maybe second in the division. So I think they can make it noise of both seasons. Because, Jason, the bottom line is there's still a lot of good players in Vegas. And I think they like have a little bit of a chip on their shoulder because they went out in the first round last year. I expect a bounce back season. Maybe not to win a second cup in Vegas, but certainly a better season than last.
Dennis Bernstein, he does a terrific job. He'll be with us all season long. TheFourthPeriod.com, SiriusXM, NHL Radio. I always appreciate it, my friend. Be well. Happy start of the NHL season.
Always being great with you, Jason. Thanks for the time. Appreciate it.
We're coming back. All right, time to put the wraps on this baby for a Monday. We're back on Tuesday. Weekend leftovers because we couldn't possibly fit in all the NFL into just that opening segment today. Lots more on the NFL tomorrow. Scheduled to have Jim Larritz on the show, former Yankee. World Series champion. Matt Verderam, too, from SI, does a great job on the NFL. He'll help us out with those Tuesday weekend leftovers on Tuesday. But in the meantime, it's time for some odds and ends. Odds and ends. It's just preseason, so we don't go crazy. But note the day in the log. Sunday, October 6th, 2024, LeBron James and Bronny James play together for the first time in Palm Desert, California at Acrisure Arena out in my old stomping grounds in the Coachella Valley. And yeah, Bronny was Bronny and he's going to develop and you know, we'll see what he winds up becoming. But I am still in awe every time I watch LeBron James step on a court. And I'm not one of these sycophantic suck-ups. I don't have any special, you know, relationship with LeBron or anything like that. But to watch him, you know, 20 years deep into this thing, in a preseason game, you know, running end-to-end, blocking Devin Booker shots. Again, stop. Whenever you get a chance to watch LeBron, take it in, because it's not going to be there forever, especially now that he's had the chance to play with his son. You know his days in the league are numbered. But still, just so, look at this. So dominant, even at this stage of his career. To be that deep into it and still be the most physically dominant player on the court, whether it's for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, out of this world. That is one odds and ends. The other, boy, we had an interesting race in Talladega. Look, you knew there were going to be wrecks. The big one, or in this case, the huge one taking place right before they finished the race. There was like four or five laps left. They wind up going to overtime. And in that overtime, Ricky Stenhouse Jr. getting his first win since Daytona, since his win at the Daytona 500. Ricky Stenhouse Jr. is your winner at Talladega. I got to say this, though, about the wrecks. I know everybody likes to watch the wrecks. Why do you watch NASCAR? You want to see a car go flipping over 15 times and a guy hop out and put his thumbs up. Nobody's hoping these guys get hurt in these wrecks. I don't watch it for that reason. But Talladega just feels like an accident waiting to happen every year. And it does just leave you wondering, like, what are we doing at Talladega? You've got four wide racing at 190 miles an hour, and you can do everything you want to try and protect these guys, and that's great. But one of these days, just one of these days, all the protections in the world aren't going to matter for the wild scene that ensues every time we race at Talladega. Odds and ends number two. Odds and ends number three, the WNBA postseason. The semifinals for the playoffs. So the Liberty, by the way, Robin Lundberg will join us on the show Wednesday to preview the WNBA finals. We know half of that final will include the New York Liberty. They defeated the Aces on Sunday. They win that series in four games. After losing game three on Saturday in Las Vegas, they came back on Sunday in game four, and boy, were they dominant. They lost Friday night game three, came back Sunday, won game four. Say this for the Connecticut Sun. The Minnesota Lynx are arguably the best team in the league. And the Connecticut Sun have now pushed them to a Game 5 back in Minnesota. I don't know what it means when we get to the WNBA Finals. And if the Lynx do manage to win the series and beat the Sun in this Game 5 and get the Liberty. They have played, you know, an extra game or two in this series that they may not have had to play just because the Sun have looked like they wanted it more. The Sun have just looked hungrier. If you take these two rosters and put them side by side, I think most people would argue Minnesota's the better team. But the Connecticut Sun have really managed to impress in the first couple of games. Or I should say the couple of wins they've had in this series. So hats off to the Connecticut Sun. They get a win in both of those games. Well, that's it. We're done. And I've still got a minute left over. What am I supposed to talk about? Here's what I want to say. For folks in the southeast part of the United States, you guys have been decimated by Hurricane Helene, and now Hurricane Milton is on the way. I know we have a huge audience in the southeast, Georgia, Florida, we're on in Miami, we're on in Atlanta, we're on in New Orleans. I just want to say to people, if you are in the path of Hurricane Milton, heed the warnings. It's Monday. This thing's not going to hit till Wednesday night. Just get out of its path. You know, we saw what just happened with the last hurricane, and I think there's like over 200 people that have perished in that storm. Heed the warnings. Listen to the meteorologists. Get out of the way of this storm. It's going to be bad. I mean, it's already a Category 4 as of Monday morning. So please, heed the warnings. Get out of its path. And hopefully everybody down there stays safe. And that's how we'll wrap up this Monday edition of Sports Wrap. Thank you to our guests. They were aplenty. Dennis Bernstein, Bill Bender, our buddy Sam Yarnell. Thanks to you for watching. Don't forget, check out the podcast version of the show, available on all your favorite podcasting platforms. Jim Larritz on the show tomorrow, along with Matt Verderam. I'm Jason Page. We'll see you later.